We ended the last program with the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the advantage our policies gave to the Soviet Union. Why was this done? Don't even begin to study history. In the May 10, 1958 issue of the National Review, historian Henry Elmer Barnes reported that Harry Truman had said that the need for such a fateful decision, of course, would never have arisen had we not been shot in the back by Japan at Pearl Harbor in December 1941. The same article also reported that the Hiroshima City Council reported to Truman as follows, quote, "Had your decision been based on the Imperial Navy's surprise attack on your country's combatants and military facilities, why could you not choose a military base for the target? You committed the outrage of massacring 200,000 non-combatants as revenge, and you are still trying to justify it." End of that quote. Well, I think I have told you before that we have a copy of the front page of the Honolulu newspaper, dated November 30, 1941, here at the local military museum, and that newspaper states that we were expecting a Japanese attack the next weekend. Secretary of War Stimson, as well as Norman Cousins and Thomas K. Finletter, rationalized that we used the atomic bomb to show our power over the Soviet Union in some future diplomatic confrontations. If this were true, then the victims of Nagasaki and Hiroshima died for a mere diplomatic edge. Is that justification? No. We did not need to drop the bomb in order to save us the trouble of a Japanese invasion. The talk of a Japanese invasion was only propaganda, so the citizens of the United States would accept the carnage of Japanese civilians. We did not need to drop the bomb in order to show the Soviet Union our strength. The Soviet Union was well aware of our strength and our weaknesses. We dropped the bomb to intimidate the peoples of the world into accepting new ideas of government, ideas which will ultimately, in the minds of the movers and shakers of the world, give all citizens of this earth new freedoms. What are some of these freedoms? Well, they'll have freedom from want, freedom from fear of war, freedom from ownership, freedom from religion, freedom from self-government, freedom from independence, freedom from choice, freedom from liberty, and finally, freedom from freedom. Well, let's talk a little bit about our allies in the Second World War. We had Churchill from Great Britain and Stalin from the Soviet Union. Most everyone knows that the Soviet Union was communist and that Karl Marx was Jewish. Most of us realize the three primary characters that played the largest role in the Soviet Empire were Lenin, Trotsky, and Stalin. Here's a little background on the three of them. Vladimir Lenin used the name Vladimir Ulyanov, which he had assumed from the Gentile side of his mother's family. Her maiden name had been Blank, but Lenin had been born Vladimir Goldman. Lev Davidovich Bronstein was Leon Trotsky's birth name. He took the name Trotsky when he was smuggled out of Siberia in a horse cart along with a blank forged passport. He wrote the name Trotsky hurriedly because that was the name of the head jailer in Siberia. Joseph Stalin was not Russian. He was born in Georgia. He was raised Catholic, but his original last name was Djugashvili, which translates to son of a Jew or Jewison. He changed his name to Stalin to denote strength, since Stalin in Russia means steel. The following is going to be a little difficult for many to believe. One can hear a lot of them say, "What? England do that to this country? Why, they are our greatest ally. We could not do without them." Let's look at the record and just see how much love there is for us in this pretended friendship. To begin with, When we were at war with Spain, this great man, Churchill, Winston Churchill, entered the British Army in 1895, serving with the Spanish forces and fired on American forces. It was a little embarrassing when the Honorable William Langer of North Dakota made this announcement on the floor of the United States Senate. Mr. Churchill at that time was in this country, and because, you know, we never hit a man behind his back, he was going to speak in Boston. A little more of the Churchillian propaganda, I guess, is what he's going to speak about. And learning that this statement had been made by the patriotic Senator Langer, Mr. Churchill was a little upset. He sent a telegram to the Honorable Tom Connolly denying the fact. Good friend as he was, Senator Connolly rose to his feet and read the telegram to the Senate. Little did they realize that the records were available, that already these facts had been read to the Senate and were in the congressional record. Once again, Senator Langer read the record to the Senate. You see, Mr. Churchill is a brilliant man, but how stupid to try to deny what he was sanctioned in his biography. For you will find the record in World's Who's Who and a very good account in International Who's Who. This preface to these books states that this volume contains an authentic record of notable men and women throughout the world. Page 114, 1940 edition states that Winston Churchill entered the British Army in 1895, serving with the Spanish forces against the American forces in Cuba. In the International Who's Who on page 158, published by the Europe Publications Limited in London, it says that Churchill entered the army in 1895, served in Cuba with Spanish forces against the Americans. The preface of this book states, "We wish to express our thanks to all those who, by completing questionnaires or by correcting proofs sent to them, have enabled us to bring information up to date and to remind others that unless proofs are returned, no responsibility can be accepted for the accuracy of their biographical records." In 1946, the Biographical Encyclopedia of the World repeats, "Churchill entered the British Army in 1895, serving with the Spanish forces in Cuba." Webster's Biographical Dictionary, first edition by G&C Merriam Publishers in Springfield, Massachusetts, states that Churchill served in Cuba with Spanish forces. In the current biography, the 1940 edition, published by H.W. Wilson & Company at 950 University Avenue, New York City, also states, "Churchill was with the Spanish forces in Cuba." It was repeated in 1942. It is here that we find Churchill quoted. He said that he had always thought it a pity that it all had to be so make-believe, and that the age of wars between civilized nations had come to an end forever. Now he, at last, had an opportunity to join civilized Spain in a war against uncivilized Cuba. Robert's account of Winston Churchill, published in 1928, stated on page 32 that through Sir Henry Drummond, ambassador to Madrid, Spain, he said that Churchill joined the Spanish forces in Cuba in 1895 and Spain conferred the Order of Military Merit, First Class, to Churchill. While the New York Times, which prints, quote, quote, "all the news that is fit to print," in their issue of September 19, 1945, states that Churchill fought with Spain in Cuba, Winston Churchill, whose mother was Jenny Jacobson Jerome, was Jewish, meaning he is Jewish under Israeli immigration law, as he was born of a Jewish mother. And he writes the following in an article on page 5 of the Illustrated Sunday Herald, dated February 8, 1920. This is his quote. He says that some people like Jews and some do not, but no thoughtful man can doubt the fact that they are beyond all question the most formidable and most remarkable race which has ever appeared in the world. And it may well be that this same astounding race may at the present time be in the actual process of producing another system of morals and philosophy as malevolent as Christianity was benevolent, which, if not arrested, would shatter irretrievably all that Christianity has rendered possible. From the days of Spartacus to those of Karl Marx and down to Trotsky in Russia, Balakun in Hungary, and Rosa Luxemburg, Germany, and Emma Goldman, United States, this worldwide conspiracy for the overthrow of civilization and for the reconstitution of society on the basis of arrested development of envious malevolence and impossible equality has been steadily growing. It played a definitely recognizable part in the tragedy of the French Revolution. It has been the mainspring of every subversive movement during the 19th century, and now at last this band of extraordinary personalities from the underworld of the great cities of Europe and America have gripped the Russian people by the hair of their heads and have become practically the undisputed masters of that enormous empire. There is no need to exaggerate the part played in the creation of Bolshevism and in the actual bringing about of the Russian Revolution by these internationals, for the most part, atheist Jews. It is certainly a very great one. It probably outweighs all others. With the notable exception of Lenin, the majority of the leading figures are Jews. And you know, later, Lenin was subsequently revealed as a Jew. The Jerusalem Post on January 18, 1993 had this to say about Churchill. Cunning no doubt came to Churchill in the Jewish genes transmitted by his mother, Lady Randolph Churchill, or Jenny Jacobson Jerome. Well, no informed person could well deny that Winston S. Churchill was probably the most spectacular showman in the history of British politics, and he was surely one of Britain's great masters of patriotic and honorific rhetoric. But when we go beyond this into any phase of Churchill's career, we enter debatable ground. Any careful study of his personality and career raises questions as to his personal and political integrity and the value of his public services to Great Britain. Churchill's shifts on communism were equally fantastic. He had been one of the most bitter critics of communism and its leaders, denouncing it as foul baboonery, but during World War II, he extolled Stalin as generously as he previously had Mussolini and Hitler, only to shift again as early as 1946, and demand a Cold War on communism. There is no convincing evidence whatsoever that Churchill ever proposed or supported any public measure with a primary interest in its probable effect on the welfare of Britain or humanity. He appeared to be exclusively concerned with its probable reaction to his own political career. In this, he differed from Roosevelt. Even John T. Flynn admits that the latter, as a country squire, had a real sense of noblesse oblige and was interested in the well-being of the common people when helping them, if it did not interfere with his own political ambitions, that is. But Churchill never revealed any sense of interest in the welfare of the common people. To him, rank only demanded special privileges and rewards. It would hardly be an exaggeration to say that he was the most vain person in the whole history of prominent public figures, a trait enduring until his death. Churchill was completely lacking in integrity with respect to his public career. He had no hesitation in uttering the most flagrant misstatements when this appeared necessary to him to promote his political ambitions or cover up his past mistakes. He did not turn aside from deceiving the British people on matters of great public import if this was required for his political self-preservation. Perhaps the best of many examples was his report to the House of Commons after his return from the disastrous Yalta Conference, where he had witnessed Stalin's duplicity and mendacious greed, having already observed this at Tehran and in the atrocious violation of Stalin's promise in regard to the Soviet treatment of Poland. Churchill assured the House, quote, "The impression I brought back from the Crimea is that Marshal Stalin and the other Soviet leaders wish to live in honorable friendship and democracy with the Western democracy. I feel that no government stands more on its obligations than the Russian Soviet government." Well, that's the end of that quote, and it is well to remember that Churchill's great current reputation as a statesman rests entirely on events between April 1940 and July 1945. He was so thoroughly discredited as a politician by 1933 that both the Baldwin and Chamberlain governments considered that to have him in the cabinet would be a detriment to conservative prestige and prospects. When public issues returned again to domestic affairs in 1945, Churchill was resoundingly defeated in the general election of that summer. As a wartime administrator, he showed tremendous energy rather than organizing and directive genius. He was more distinguished for his pugnacity than for his statescraft, although there can be no doubt that he inspired the British to unite and continue the war against Hitler, but it may be questioned if unthinking resistance to Hitler after Dunkirk was the best policy for Britain. The most effective indictment of Churchill's wartime statescraft is that after gaining military victory, he lost the peace to Soviet Russia. There has been no greater fallacy than to regard Churchill as a military genius, although it is probable that no other important British leader has so loved war or worked harder to ensure it when it seemed within the range of possibility. Churchill was responsible for the disastrous attempt to force the Dardanelles in 1915, which was Britain's most spectacular defeat in the World War I, except for the futile attempt to break through the German trenches. It had been said that it was a good plan if it had worked, but a truly good military plan must work out in practice and not merely be impressive on paper. Both Lord Fisher and Lord Kirchner warned against the project. Churchill was compelled to resign as responsible for the failure. In regard to World War II, both English and American experts have indicated that Churchill's interference in strategic decisions was often disastrous. General Albert C. Wiedemeyer has pointed out that Churchill and Roosevelt really ran military operations like a pair of Indian chiefs conducting a scalping party, with little consideration of the ultimate military or political outcome. Churchill's constant demand to concentrate the Allied attack against the soft underbelly of Europe, which is a sort of return to the Dardanelles fantasy, was properly discredited by the impressive manner in which General Kesselring defended the Italian sector of the soft underbelly under the greatest handicaps, defeated in the end mainly by the treachery of Hitler and his SS underlings. It is held, even by restrained admirers of Churchill, that we must at least give him credit for saving Britain. One might ask, saving Britain from who and from what? Hitler was a worse bootlicker of Britain than the Kaiser, and the concentration of his foreign policy was to achieve a permanent understanding with Britain. Even after Dunkirk, where Hitler deliberately permitted the British to escape, he offered Britain a generous peace and told his generals that he would put the German Air Force and Navy at the service of Britain to preserve the British Empire. But statesmanship would have dictated Churchill's agreeing to a stalemate with Germany in June of 1941 and letting Germany and Russia bleed each other white and thus remove the threat of dictatorship from either the right or the left. This was what wise Americans like Herbert Hoover, Robert A. Taft, and Harry S. Truman recommended at the time. But as Roosevelt put it, Churchill was just getting too much joy and thrill, having too much fun out of being an active war leader to consider for a moment retiring to the role of an observer, even if this was probably the only way to assure British safety and the preservation of the empire. He condemned England to 4 years of costly and brutal warfare, failed to protect Eastern and Central Europe from Russia and communism, and made inevitable the liquidation of the British Empire. Churchill led in the denunciation of the alleged horrible atrocities and brutalities of the Nazis, but his record is surely no better. He rejected Hitler's proposal at the outset of the war to ban all bombardment of non-military objectives and launched this barbarous form of bombing on May 11, 1940, with an attack on the helpless university town of Freiburg. He announced that he would stop at no type or extent of brutality and terrorism to crush Hitler, and he made good on his word. He directed the terrible incendiary bombing of Hamburg and was solely responsible for ordering the needless destruction of the beautiful city of Dresden, the most ruthless, despicable, and indefensible major atrocity of World War II, in which the losses of life and property were far greater than in the case of the American bombing of either Hiroshima or Nagasaki. He approved and ordered the application of the Lindman Plan for the saturation bombing of Germany, which, for stark brutality in both conception and operation, matched any of the alleged Nazi extermination measures. This plan ordered concentration of British bombing on the homes of the poorer, or working classes, whose houses were huddled close together, so that more innocent civilians could be killed per bomb that was dropped. In his remarks at the funeral of Mr. Churchill, former President Dwight Eisenhower laid main stress on Churchill's achievements as a friend of peace. It would be no exaggeration to say that this was not unlike J. Edgar Hoover paying a special tribute to Al Capone as a friend of law enforcement. Even his British admirers have conceded Churchill's lifelong and inordinate love of war. No other British public figure worked as hard to bring Britain into World War I as did Churchill. This has been admitted in the recent book, 12 Days, written by the English writer George Malcolm Thompson on the crisis of 1914. It is common knowledge that Churchill was the leader of the British War Party from 1936 onward, having told General Robert E. Wood in that year that Germany is getting too strong, we must smash her. He not only cooperated with the War Party in Britain, but also worked closely with Bernard Baruch and other powerful war-minded Americans. Perhaps the best summary appraisal of Churchill's personality comes from the distinguished British publicist F. S. Oliver. He said, quote, that from his youth, Mr. Churchill has loved with all his heart, with all his mind, with all his soul, and with all his strength, three things: war, politics, and himself. He has loved war for its dangers. He loved politics for the same reason, and himself he has always loved for the knowledge that his mind is dangerous. Dangerous to his enemies, dangerous to his friends, and dangerous to himself. I can think of no man I have ever met who would so quickly and so bitterly eat his heart out in paradise. The significance of Churchill's career for this and later generations was admirably summarized by the British journal The European. It said, quote, "In terms of personal success, there has been no career more fortunate than that of Winston Churchill in terms of human suffering to millions." Following is a conversation between the Zionist leader and first president of Israel, Chaim Weizmann, and Winston Churchill. To quote Mr. Weizmann, he said that he received me not only cordially, but he was also full of confidence with respect to the war. His first words were, after he had welcomed me, were, "Well, Mr. Weizmann, we have as good as beaten them already." I thanked him for his constant support for the Zionist cause. "You were standing at the cradle of this enterprise," I said to him, "and hopefully you will live to see that we have succeeded," adding that after the war we would build up a state of 3 or 4 million Jews in Palestine, whereupon Churchill replied, "Yes, go ahead. I am in full agreement with this idea." The same was pretty much true in this country under Franklin Delano Roosevelt's watch. Harry Dexter White, the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury under Harry Morgenthau Jr., was the 7th youngest child of Jewish-Lithuanian immigrants, Joseph White, spelled W-E-I-T, and Sarah Megalewski. He passed numerous secrets to the Soviet Union during the war, especially during the period when the Soviet Union was the ally of the United States. He was the senior American official at the 1944 Bretton Woods Conference. White dominated the conference and imposed his vision of post-war financial institutions over the objections of John Maynard Keynes, the British representatives. After the war, White was a major architect in the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. We'll talk more about these organizations on our next program. But White also authored the ultimatum adopted as official policy by FDR that upped the ante of belligerent acts Roosevelt was directing at Japan. White's plan was calculated to inflame public opinion in Japan and undermine Emperor Hirohito and his prime minister, both of whom favored peace with the United States. But White's ultimatum was the work not of White or anyone else in this country. It had its origins in the Soviet Union, where it was written and designed to get America and Japan into fighting each other so that Japan would be too busy to cause the Soviets any trouble. A retired Soviet spy master even said years later that, quote, "The war in the Pacific could have been avoided." And the World War II hero of the Soviet Union, Vladimir Karpov, in the year 2000, nearly 60 years after Pearl Harbor, said that Stalin was the real initiator of the ultimatum to Japan. Harry Morgenthau Jr., the Secretary of the Treasury under FDR, was born into a prominent Jewish family in New York City, the son of Henry Morgenthau, a real estate mogul and diplomat. Earlier in this program, I mentioned that Churchill could become a citizen of Israel because his mother was Jewish, which means that he was Jewish under the Israeli immigration law, as he was born to a Jewish mother. Under the Jewish immigration law, anyone whose mother, grandmother, great-grandmother, or great-great-grandmother was Jewish is qualified for Israeli citizenship. Well, the big hand on the clock is about to hit the number 12, which means that my time is up. Hope you join us next time on Money Matters. So long.